Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, and welcome to the subscriber version of Inside Total Film. And thank you for taking out a subscription with us. We know that you're a smarter person for subscribing to the Smarter Movie Magazine. Today, I'm joined by our editor-at-large, Jamie Graham.
Hello.
And one of our contributors, Ashanti Onka.
Hello.
Hello, you two. So this week, we're going to be buzzing the tower with Top Gun Maverick and talking to the director, Joseph Kosinski. Plus, we're weighing up Men, Elizabeth, a Portrait in Parts, Between Two Worlds, and Bob's Burgers. But first of all, before we get on to those, what have you guys been watching? Jamie, what have you been feasting your eyes on this week?
I've been watching loads of stuff this week, actually. I started Bosch Legacy, which I'm now up to date with all the episodes which are up, which I think is 8 now. So I've done 8 episodes of that. And it's kind of a spin-off of Bosch, as you would expect from the title, and it retains most of the same characters. And the ones who were in Bosch who aren't in Bosch Legacy, they just pop up here and there for cameos. It's the same world, obviously. And it's absolutely wonderful. I've watched all of The Lincoln Lawyer, which, again, like, I really liked the film, and I was not happy about Matthew McConaughey not being in a TV series, but it's really good. It's sort of a cross between Bosch and the Jack Reacher series that came out earlier this year, and it's just very smart, kind of slick, entertaining. So I would recommend that. And I've also been watching the Amy Schumer TV show, Life and Beth.
Yes.
Which has been up for a while. So I've been catching up with that. And then on the film front side,
How is there time for films, Jamie?
There's always time for films, Jane. There's always time. I've been re-watching all the Jacques Tati, Monsieur Hulot films from the 1950s and 1960s, which is just, I mean, basically Monsieur Hulot was a big influence on Mr. Bean. It's that kind of bumbling humor, sort of going around and everything going wrong, bit of slapstick here and there. And it's just so light and wonderful and witty and just like immersing yourself in a gorgeous hot bathtub. It's just so enjoyable. So I've really enjoyed those just to relax. And I've also started, I always give myself seasons of films, and I've just embarked on a Tom Cruise season to tie in with Maverick.
Where are you up to?
Well, I'm not doing it in order, but I'm just going back and watching a lot of his films. So this week I watched Magnolia, Colour of Money, Cocktail. And I'm going to watch Days of Thunder tonight. So there's no rhyme or reason to it. I'm just sort of whatever I fancy on any given day.
Days of Thunder is, why have you left that one? Like, that's not a treat to watch, is it?
Well, the thing is, I've only seen Days of Thunder once when it came out, and I didn't like it when it came out. I was really disappointed. You know, Tony Scott, Tom Cruise after Top Gun. I found it very disappointing, their reunion. But that was now like 30 years ago or something. So I really thought, you know, most Cruise films I've seen several times or many times in some cases. And I thought I really should go back with fresh eyes and give it another look. So I'm going to watch it tonight.
I think you'll still be disappointed, frankly. But
probably. We'll see.
Yeah. Apart from that's got a banging theme tune, hasn't it? Show Me Heaven by Maria McKee. Cracking. But apart from that, nah. Ashanti, what have you been watching?
Well, I had the pleasure of popping by the massive pink carpet global premiere in Leicester Square of Danny Boyle's Pistol, which hits Disney Plus on 31st of May. And this one, it's based on a memoir called Lonely Boy, Tales from a Sex Pistol by the guitarist Steve Jones. And there's an interesting total film connection here, actually, because the young boy who plays the young version of Steve Jones, Toby Wolf, he dazzled in Billy Piper's Rare Beasts, and I had written a review for Total Film, and his mother recognized me from the review, came over and said hi, and I had like a picture and got to meet him, and he's grown up since Rare Beasts, and, you know, it was a really lovely moment, actually, and she said, yes, we love the review in Total Film. It obviously meant a lot to them, which was so lovely to see. And this was, it was an epic, massive, massive Disney Plus premiere. A lot of the cast and crew were there as well. And this obviously is about the punk rock band. I must admit, I was never a fan of the Sex Pistols. It was slightly before my time. But hey, you know, they made such a big dent in the cultural landscape and brought that. I think they after they came on board, there were lots of other punk bands that also did. But I was always kind of a pop and R&B person, so I didn't quite get into them. But you know, Danny Boyle, he's always stellar in what he does. So I love his work. And I was talking to another actress who was there, Amber, and I noticed that Danny Boyle had hit the pink carpet. And she said, "How did you recognize him from the back of his head?" Like, that's the power of Danny Boyle. So that's out, yeah, 31st May on Disney Plus. And it's well worth a watch. It's nice to see this kind of retelling of the story of the Pistols.
Yeah, marvellous. Well, obviously, there was another little film that had a red carpet in the last week, wasn't there? Tiny little independent release that had a huge jet and some royals. What was that?
Was it Top Gun Maverick or something, was it called?
It might have been. I think it's probably time for those famous bongs to come in now. Have a listen. Here we go. So you know where we're going with this, everyone. It's time to talk about this.
Everyone here is the best there is. Who the hell are they going to get to teach us?
Captain Pete Maverick Mitchell. Let me be perfectly blunt. You are not my first choice. You are here at the request of Admiral Kazansky, a.k.a. Iceman. He seems to think that you have something left to offer the Navy. What that is, I can't imagine.
With all due respect, sir, I'm not a teacher. Just want to manage the expectations.
What the hell?
Good morning, aviators. This is your captain speaking.
So that is Top Gun Maverick, the long-awaited sequel to Top Gun. And before we get into whether it's an ace or a sitting duck, let's hear what director Joseph Kosinski had to say when our online reporter Faye Watson sat down with him last week. Here's what they chatted about.
And we're off.
Here we go. In 3, 2, 1...
So I think it's fair to say that this has kind of been a bit of a long time coming to come
yes.
out. So is it a thrill to kind of seeing it out in the world now?
Absolutely. I mean, for me, it's the end of a five-year journey. These last 2 years waiting for theaters to open has been tough, but the film was designed to be seen on the big screen with big movie sound and a packed auditorium. So we're all very excited to finally be able to show it to people.
Yeah, it's a very cinematic film, right? I think obviously a big part of that are those incredible flight sequences. I don't think anyone's going to have seen anything like that before, right?
I don't think so. No. Not quite like this.
Was it quite daunting when you found out that was going to be like a big part of the film, or was it maybe part of the attraction for you?
I mean, that was, a requirement for me. I mean, a reason to do the movie was just the challenge of figuring out a way to actually capture these sequences for real. I had seen on YouTube, these Navy pilots were putting GoPro cameras on their canopies and just grabbing like a little image over their shoulder of their training routes. And I showed that to Tom and said, this is what's out there for free on the internet. If we can't beat this, there's no point in making this film. And he obviously agreed 100%. So then it began a 15-month process of trying to figure out at first how to get one or two cameras into a F-18 Super Hornet, and we eventually figured out how to get 6. I knew we'd be able to get Tom in the jet and capture that footage. I didn't know if it was going to be possible. I really wanted to try to get everyone else in the jet as well. Jerry told me that don't count on it. He said we tried with the first film and no one could go up there, but Tom designed a flight training course for all the other actors that got them acclimated to the forces of flying. And it prepped them just enough that they could pull these scenes off for real. So the idea of getting everyone all their scenes, you know, for real, really, I think, opens the film up and makes it feel the way we want it, which is it gives you a little glimpse into what it's like to be a Top Gun pilot.
It must have been quite a unique challenge for you because obviously you can't be up there directing them.
Right.
Right. So how did you manage that and getting them to kind of self-direct?
It's a lot of rehearsal, a lot of planning. We would start every flight day with a two-hour brief with all the Top Gun pilots and the actors, Tom, myself, the DP, the editor. We'd go through every single shot. You know, I storyboarded the whole film, did over 3,800 storyboards. We previs sequences, and then we had stick models, little planes on sticks, and we'd sit there and show all the kind of ideas and what the shot was and what the choreography would be. And then after the brief, we would go and we would rehearse the scene in a mock-up of the F-18 cockpit where I could stand right next to the actor and their pilot. And we'd go through every line, every shot, every eye line, everything they needed to do to pull these scenes off. Then they'd go up in the airplane. We had all six cameras wired to one switch in the cockpit that they would turn on when they were ready to shoot. They would shoot the scene. They would come back an hour later. I'd put the footage right into the playback. We'd all sit around and watch it together and give notes on things that didn't work and applaud them for things that did work. If we needed more, we'd send them up again in the afternoon. So it was a very tedious, slow process, but we saw that we were getting footage that you just can't get anywhere else.
Yeah, and so you're back on the ground in that hour. How's the wait? Is it a bit nerve-wracking? Or
there's always something to do, you know? There's always, and you know, maybe you're prepping the other actor to go up in the other plane. So it's very busy. Those were very long days, 14 hours. I'd run back to the editorial trailer where Eddie Hamilton was assembling the footage, and we'd look and say, do we got it? Do we got to give him notes? Do we need to get something else? So it was very hectic, intense process, but you couldn't have gotten this footage any other way. And hopefully we're going to show people something they've never seen before.
Were you ever kind of tempted to get up there yourself, or did you by any chance?
I didn't get to fly in an F-18. I now have an open invitation from the Navy to do so, which I will take them up on. I did get flown occasionally by Tom in his jet. You know, we'd pull a couple G's, you know, going over some cumulus clouds on the way back to LA. So I got a little taste of it.
Yeah, and it also kind of really struck me when I was watching it how tense those moments are. Kind of when you're piecing together the film, like how does that work? Do you want to have the kind of highs and lows of that?
It all starts with the script. You know, you need to have the story. You need to have characters that you care about, because if you don't care about the characters, then it's just action for action's sake. So that work is all starts in the script. And then, yeah, the editorial on this film was a massive undertaking. The third act sequence, that last 30, 35 minutes, it took Eddie, I think, 3 months to just do the first assembly, which is like the rough version of it, which was excellent and 80% of the way there. But it's a massive undertaking. We had 813 hours of footage on this movie, which had to be cut down to 2. So that's amazing editorial team, amazing editor, and Eddie Hamilton and Stephen Marioni and Chris Lebenson, who came in to also help. And, you know, we figured out a way to kind of get it down.
And you speak a bit about kind of needing to care for these characters. I think when I was watching it, one of the things that really struck me was quite how emotional I found it. I wasn't really expecting to have that kind of gut punch feeling. I think maybe the first time I feel it is in the bar when we see Bradley come in.
Yeah.
And you're seeing it through Maverick's eyes, aren't you?
Right.
But yeah, it was really emotional. So how did you kind of get that right? How did you film that?
Well, this film benefits from the film that precedes it, because the friendship between Goose and Maverick really is, I think, that element that people really remember from the first film. And the notion of a wingman is something that we use in everyday life because of that first film. So having that to build from is really powerful. And the opportunity to do that doesn't come along very often, to build on such a beloved film. So using the Goose Maverick storyline as the foundation for his relationship with Rooster was really important. And obviously the film hints at that. But, you know, the fact that Miles bears some resemblance to Goose, you know, I think helps in that moment. And you're able to build from there. So I'm glad that worked for you.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was reading that you kind of had him in mind from the beginning, Miles. Is that right?
I had just finished a film with Miles called Only the Brave, where he had done an excellent job. And so when I went into that first pitch meeting with Tom to talk to him about the film, I actually had a picture of Miles with me, with blonde hair. And I think I might have even photoshopped a mustache on him just to say, hey, I just worked with this guy. He's really, really good. He's, I think, a great option. And, you know, Miles still had to go through the audition process like everybody else, and he won the role on his own. You hope that they'll have chemistry, you know, you hope that the relationship will work, and but you never know till you start filming, and it was evident that these two guys were going to be great together.
Yeah, and I mean, you're talking a bit about the first film and that kind of foundational relationship between Maverick and Goose. I mean, we do touch on the grief of losing him in the first film. It's there, but it's such a fast-paced film. And I also think the grief is just so fresh for Maverick in that film. Coming into this one, was it something you really wanted to kind of dig deeper into, like how that grief grows and also how it kind of has changed Maverick over the years?
Yeah, well, listen, we didn't want to open the film with what we were calling Sad Mav, which is a guy who's just wallowing in something that happened 36 years ago, because that's just not realistic. You know, he was cleared of any wrongdoing in the first film. It was an awful tragedy, but he's back out there. He's still Maverick. He's pushing the envelope. He's defying authority. He's on the very edge of what is possible in aviation. And that's why that opening sequence is so important with Maverick and Dark Star, is showing that he's still out there doing what he does best. But when he gets pulled back into Top Gun, that's when those old memories start to get brought back up by seeing Rooster and these things that maybe he hasn't thought about in a while. These emotions start to bubble up, and he realizes that there's some things he still needs to deal with. So it is a rite of passage story like Maverick in the first film, but it is a different journey in this one.
Yeah, and how important was it for you kind of going into this to make sure it was a different journey for him and wasn't just kind of a rehashing of what we've already seen?
None of us wanted to do the cover band version of Top Gun. We knew it had to be its own story. It had to stand on its own. You had to be able to watch it not having seen the first film and still enjoy it, which we found people do. We wanted there to be new characters. We wanted it to be to feel like a Top Gun movie, so there had to be that connection to the past, and we have that with Maverick and Iceman and even the character of Penny Benjamin's mentioned in the first film. But we also have all these new characters and new personalities that come in and reflect who the Navy is today, which is a different world than it was in 1986.
I mean, you mentioned Iceman a bit there, obviously kind of sidestepping spoilers, but how great was it to have Val Kilmer back in the film and work with him?
Amazing. I mean, I've, like everyone, been a huge fan of his, not only for Iceman, but for, you know, Heat and Tombstone and all the other great films he's made. So to get a chance to work with him was a dream come true. To do it with him playing Iceman and to be able to do it in a scene where he and Tom are together, two people who have so much respect for each other, and to have it be a reunion of not only two characters, but two men in real life, really emotional day, really memorable day on set.
Can imagine.
Yeah.
We're talking a bit about how you brought in all these new characters as well. How was the kind of casting process to find them? I mean, I think Jerry said that a lot of people didn't really want to get in the F-18s, and that helped narrow it down a little bit.
There were some people that were like afraid to fly commercial, and I was like, okay, this is not the movie for you. I looked at hundreds of people. I had an incredible casting director, Denise Jamian, who brought in a lot of faces that I never seen before, wasn't familiar with, people from TV, you know, up-and-coming actors who hadn't done a lot of work. And she just put all these great people in front of me, and I did a lot of, you know, crazy casting sessions where I had them pulling G's in an office chair, like in a small room. You know, just, it's crazy the stuff I made them do, but I was determined to find people that really felt authentic to this world, having at that point met a lot of Top Gun pilots and spent a lot of time with, you know, on bases and on a carrier. I would narrow it down to kind of what I thought were like the top two or three best. And then I sat down with Jerry and Tom and we watched all the tape together. And, you know, I was able to use all their experience and we made our choices. Luckily, I think we chose correctly. I mean, they're just great. And that's what really makes the film work, is great casting.
And then Tom had that intense kind of period for them where they learned how to build up slowly to flying in the planes.
Yeah, Tom designed the flying training because he knew that without that, they wouldn't be able to pull off these scenes. So Tom's a pilot, does aerobatics, you know, has been flying for 25 years. So he knew exactly what the training course should be and designed that and got them, you know, ready for these sequences.
How was it watching them go through that? Was it brutal at times?
Yeah, certainly. I knew what they were going through was really hard, but the results looked so great. I promised them it was worth it, and I know it was really hard. So that's another thing that makes this so gratifying, to finally be here and have them be watching the movie with an audience and see people really feeling, you know, a little bit of what they were going through. It's finally paying off.
How did you kind of go about working out who was going to be called what, and what was the process of that?
Some of them came out of the script. Some of them were in there. A few of them, like Hangman and Rooster, were ones where, you know, I let them pick their own. It's important that they be able to identify with the call sign and be able to kind of assign a character to it. You know, I just wanted everyone to really like their call sign and be able to kind of embody it.
Did you get a cool sign or?
I got one from the call sign generator, Battlestar. It's a little over the top. It stuck for some reason. It was on my office door. So you don't get to pick your own call sign typically. And so I was kind of stuck with it.
That one sounds good.
Thanks.
I was wondering a little bit about, we spoke about it already, but kind of working out how to have those callbacks to the original film, but then also getting this one to stand on its own two feet. How did you kind of balance that?
It was something we constantly dealt with, not only in the writing, but also in the editing of the film. I knew at the beginning I wanted it to feel like a Top Gun movie right from the opening frames. Like, that was just, to me, the only way to open this film. So you're telling people, this is a Top Gun movie. We love Top Gun as much as you, you know. Don't worry. It's going to be a Top Gun film. But then a few minutes after that, when Maverick pulls into that hangar at China Lake Naval Air Station, we're showing them that we're going to take this story in a whole new direction. And it's not going to be exactly the Top Gun that you remember. It's going to go in its own direction.
And did you have any favorite callbacks that you got in there? Any Easter eggs?
There's a moment where Maverick in this film says, too close for missiles, switching to guns, which is almost a exact copy from the first film. You cut to an insert of Maverick switching the switch on the thumbstick from missiles to guns, which is totally fictional. That's not how the F-14 is set up. We actually copied the insert from the original movie to the point that we even put a very visible sticker on the stick that says missiles and guns, which is very movie, but we actually copied it anyway to make it look fake, like the first movie. So that was a very insidery, very quick Easter egg for the hardcore Top Gun fans.
And then how about the volleyball sequence? I mean, in this one, we have an American football sequence. How was that to film?
For me, it was a lot of fun. For the actors, it was a lot of stress. That's one of those scenes where every actor had that date circled on their calendar 3 months ahead of time. You know, that's the day where you got to show it off. So they all worked very, very hard getting ready. There was a lot of baby oil. There might have been some tears, you know, shed in the background, you know, because these people had not been eating, not drinking probably enough water. And when the day came, they looked spectacular. They had fun. I just tried to shoot the best version of I could. We ended up shooting it over 2 or 3 days, which prolonged the torture for them, I think, a little bit in terms of the eating. But that camaraderie that you see on screen was happening off screen as well. So it was really, really fun.
Yeah. Do you kind of just kind of let the cameras roll, or is there a lot of direction in that kind of thing?
It's it's all a little more precise than maybe it's meant to be. I mean, everything, you know, we did lots of choreography, lots of rehearsals, very specific angles and lenses and time of day and all that. So, you know, filmmaking is very specific to get, you know, that image. It takes a lot of work. My goal is to kind of try to figure everything else out and then let the actors enjoy themselves in a scene like that and be natural, because otherwise it's not going to feel fun, you know? So it's a little bit of both.
So Jamie, that was the director of Top Gun Maverick talking about it, but tell us, just give us a little quick intro into where we find Pete Maverick Mitchell these days.
Okay. Well, it's obviously 36 years later since the original film came out in 1986. And Maverick, he's kind of older, a little bit wiser, but not too much wiser. And he's still the same stubborn, mischievous, cocky self in many ways. So we find him in the desert and he's about to pilot a jet, a huge jet, to try and go Mach 10 for the first time that any human pilot has flown Mach 10. And he is actually the mission is about to be shut down, that there is an admiral played by Ed Harris, who everyone calls the Drone Ranger, because he wants to get rid of dogfighting and human pilots and thinks it's time that, you know, drones do it all. The Maverick's way would be gone in the ashes of time. And the mission is being shut down, but Maverick, in true Maverick style, kind of ignores this. The Admiral is on the way to the desert to shut him down. And before he arrives, Maverick gets in a jet, takes off and goes, right, I'm going to give him Mach 10 and prove it can be done. I don't think anyone's even hit Mach 9 at this point. So that's where we meet him. So he's being his old stubborn self. And then unbelievably, he has to be sent back to Top Gun. But there is a mission that needs flying that only human dogfighting pilots can do. So drones can't do this at all. And the only man capable of teaching the young pilots, the young hotshots to do it, is Maverick. He's the only one who's sort of skilled in the art and good enough and has the experience. So all these years later, he goes back to Top Gun as an instructor with a new team of cocky young recruits. And he has 3 weeks to whip them into shape and get them to fly this absolutely impossible mission where an unnamed enemy, has a uranium-enriched plant and it has to be taken out before it becomes operational.
Indeed. There's also, you know, there's a lot of ties to the past, but none more so than the fact that his former best friend and co-pilot, his wingman, Goose, his son is one of these new recruits, which obviously caused a lot of issues. And the lady that runs the local bar is his old flame, Penny. But those aren't the only callbacks, are they, Jamie? This is a film that knows exactly what it's doing, doesn't it, in terms of fan service?
It's very much fan service. There's probably about 10 or 15 callbacks where, you know, to the stuff like the famous scenes like volleyball on the beach and the opening with the silhouetted planes on the carrier on the ocean and the music playing and the highway to the danger zone. And there's all these callbacks. It very much does kind of throw itself into the nostalgia 2 feet, you know, plunges in there. But it's all done really cleverly. But every single callback has a slight twist to it, or it does have something to do with the plot. It does kind of further the plot. It's not just there for the sake of it. So it could become too much. It could be like, oh, God, you know, not another callback. But I think it gets it just right. And if you're a big fan of the original, which I am, I was 14 when it came out, watched it many, many times, and it gives you exactly what you want. But it also stands as its own thing, that it has got its own plot. Training these guys for a mission is different to the first one. The fact that it's against the clock, you know, that time is ticking, and it is its own thing. And it's got its own tone as well. But Maverick, he's now in his 50s. And like I said, even though he's cocky, he is a bit more world weary. He's got a slightly mournful air to him, a kind of, you know, where do I stand now in the world? Is my time up? He's kind of looking back to the past and any mistakes he may have made and sort of former glories that have faded. So it's got this kind of mournful air to it, which I didn't expect. And I think it works absolutely perfect. I've got to say, I am a huge fan of this film. You know,
yes, you gave it 5 stars.
I did. I don't think it's possible to make a better Top Gun sequel 36 years later. I think it hits every single note you want it to. I mean, obviously, the aerial photography is just incredible. We all know Cruise does it himself. He goes up in a jet. He made all the young cast members go up in jets, you know, and sort of fly with the wind in their hair, you know.
There's no wind in the hair. They're in a cockpit, Jamie. No, if there's wind in their hair, something's gone terribly wrong.
Okay, fire. Hair on fire. That's what I'm looking for. Hair on fire.
Again, but something's gone terribly wrong if that's
It
happened.
Has gone terribly wrong. Terribly wrong. But no, but you can really feel it. I mean, we're so used to CG films now and sort of superheroes diving around with no real stakes. And, you know, you don't feel any real sense of jeopardy. And in this film, you do. You're really clinging to the edge of your seat. Unbelievable aerial photography. They filmed 800 hours of footage and cut the film down from there. So you can imagine how extraordinary some of that stuff is. But where it surprised me is it just gets everything else right. Like all the new, like young guns, the hot shots are such, you know, charismatic. It's a great class of people you love hanging out with. I've got to give a call out to Glenn Powell.
Oh, you do surprise me. You're like Glenn Powell's number one fan.
Oh, He's a guy, he was in Everybody Wants Them, and he was in that Netflix romantic comedy Set It Up, which became a big deal. You know, it really took off. And the guy just burns charisma. He's a cross between a young Iceman and a young Maverick, but he's ice cool. But he also, like Maverick, he kind of does his own thing, and he's cocky, and he's above everyone else in terms of he won't be told what to do. And he sort of leaves his wingman if he wants to leave him and all this stuff. But he, every time he's on, you know, on the screen, he just burns charisma. You can't stop looking at him. But I think this sequel is absolutely great. 5 stars. I think it's up there with like the all-time great sequels. I know this sounds so
Aliens. Hyperbolic.
I think, you know, if you're talking stuff like Aliens and Terminator 2, it's in that class for me. It's in that class. I think maybe time will tell. Maybe it's too soon to say. But I think, you know, it's not a million miles from those two in terms of what a sequel can be to a beloved first film.
Well, you are talking from a fan point of view. Ashanti. Yes. Now, Ashanti took her family who had never seen Top Gun. From that point of view, does it work for people who have no idea about, you know, the feeling the need for speed and have nothing invested in this?
Oh, well, what can I say? My two nieces had never seen it. So they are kind of in their early 20s, just out of university, just starting life, never seen the first one. And they both came out beaming. This film does hit all the high notes. I do agree with Jamie, but I have to say from my personal perspective, I was disappointed by one huge bit that I felt they didn't bring into the sequel that they should have, especially 36 years down the line. And that's the fact that when I saw this film as a child, there was a woman of power, as in not, you know, yes, she was a love interest, but she was an astrophysicist. She was their trainer. You know, Kelly McGillis oozed kind of this, I'm a powerful woman in that. And she was based on a real life Pentagon officer, you know, yes. Christine Fox. And to see that this film brought back only one woman in the team, you know, with Monica Barbaro is amazing in it. And I know that they picked people very specifically to be the crew. And I know that Tom Cruise said, can you go through this training? Do you have the fitness level for me to be able to dunk you under the water just in case you fall from one of these planes that we're flying? So there was a lot of criterion around it, but I just felt like they, by putting in, you know, kind of John Hamm, and, you know, I love that, but why didn't they replace his character with a woman is my question, because we had that. If we could have, you know, the Kelly McGillis character of Charlotte Blackwood in the 80s, then why not in 2022? Because why is the one woman is part of the gang, that's great, and one woman is his love interest who runs a bar. I just felt that was something that they could have fixed for 2022. And so that takes off one mark from me, because yes, it's a much more colorful bunch of recruits and you see a few more people of color having a few more lines to say. But I felt that, you know, this was a bit of an oversight, and I wonder why. It's my only kind of issue with the film, because I wanted my nieces to have seen this film and then said, hey, maybe I'll think about STEM science. Maybe I'll think about, you know, a career working in this kind of exciting arena. But they would have come out of it thinking, well, one woman is his love interest and she's good enough to be a barkeep, but not, you know, not good enough to work with this team of men.
Yeah.
It was very much a bromance.
It's a very good point. And the reason that Kelly McGinnis hasn't come back is steeped in mystery, isn't it? No one seems to have an answer for this. She's not spoken about it. So we're just not really clear whether she refused to partake or what the deal was. But you're right, this is weird that Charlie isn't brought back, but that Penny is. And Penny is somebody who in the original film is mentioned in passing as an admiral's daughter that Maverick took an F-16 flight with or something and got into a lot of trouble. So she is sort of a woman who's within the Navy, but only in terms of, you know, her father was an admiral. As a barkeep, she's extremely wealthy. She has a very nice house. She has a huge sailing boat. She has a wonderful wardrobe and a vintage Porsche. So I want to know, what's Penny's side hustle? Because it's clearly not barkeeping, is it? Because that woman hasn't done that her whole life. So that aside, and, you know, let's talk about Jennifer Connelly, because she's delightful in this. And also, although we're not seeing Charlie, we are seeing a woman that's the right age for Cruise, which we don't often see on screen. She's 51 years old and she's the correct age for a man of his age. And it's really nice to see a woman that's very self-assured in herself. She whips his ass. She really humiliates him at the bar and, you know, doesn't, you know, let him have his own way. So I did enjoy that aspect of her character. But yeah, you're right. It is a strange, unknowable thing as to why Charlie hasn't come back.
I didn't need Charlie to come back. I just needed to see a woman of power, especially since we've gone through this whole motion of people saying we want equality. And I just felt like the equality just didn't show up in the story. I mean, everything else was perfect. And honestly, I absolutely loved it. Everything worked for me. But this one was a sticky point for me. And I just felt like, why? Yes. Why, Dr. Cruz? Yes. Why?
Yeah. Okay, so if everything worked for you, what was a highlight? What did you love the most, Jamie?
Oh, God, you've caught me with that question because I loved it all. But the thing is, I don't want to give too much away, but there's one action sequence where basically everyone feels this mission can't be done and they're training and training and training because they have to do it within 3 minutes, the whole mission, to pull it off in time. It just seems impossible that, you know, you can't do it in under 4 minutes, under 5 minutes. And they're about to pull the plug on it. And then Maverick sets out to prove it can be done. And that sequence is just tremendous.
It's so fist pumping, isn't it?
Oh my God, it's so tense and it's so exhilarating and it is fist pumping. You just want to get up on the cinema seat and punch the sky. You know, I mean, this is what blockbuster cinema is all about. It's about giving those thrills and giving that spectacle, but also having the characters that you care for and the story. And, you know, it's not just empty CGI spectacle. It's proper filmmaking. And Christopher McQuarrie, Cruise's old pal and, you know, partner and director, you know, he's done the last couple of Mission Impossibles and he did Jack Reacher. And he's a producer on this film and he co-wrote this film and he was also in the edit suite sort of helping out shaping the film. And he's just such an exemplary filmmaker and you really feel his fingerprints on it as well. But it's just so well made. It's an expertly crafted blockbuster, you know, full marks.
Yeah, absolutely. Ashanti, favourite bits?
Goodness gracious, great balls of fire. Oh my gosh, they brought that. And how? I mean, Miles Teller is just perfect as Rooster. And in some of those sequences, watching him, I just felt like, am I just doing a double take?
He really does look like him, doesn't he?
Wow. I mean, wow. And then him playing that piano and then them giving us that nostalgic flashback of him sitting on the piano with his dad. I probably let out a little squeal when that came up. And I kind of watched my two nieces who were sitting with me at the IMAX and both of them had this big smile on their faces. Both of them are into music. And that scene just, you know, for those of us who've watch the first one, we would just kind of get goosebumps with that scene. And for people who haven't seen it, it just makes you beam and smile, you know. And you've got Tom Cruise also bringing his A game with acting, because you can see his face, you can see his reaction to what's going on. It takes him back, obviously, and gives him that kind of bout of very poignant nostalgia. And it was an absolutely perfect scene. And what can I say? I still have a slight tear in my eye thinking about it, because you've got, you know, thinking of Goose and then you're thinking, oh my God, it's Rooster. And wow, Miles Teller, I mean, I think he's just going to grow and grow into one of the finest actors out there.
Speaking of acting, I mean, I think that this is actually one of Cruise's best performances, and I didn't expect that. I thought he'd just be doing the wearing the sunglasses, cocky strutting, you know, the megawatt smile, but actually there's so much nuance in his performance in this, which again, this goes back to Jamie and the fact that this is a blockbuster with great heart. And you know, the emotional lifting that he does in this film about grief and loss, and he's not only, you know, grieving somebody he lost, you know, 36 years ago, but he's also grieving somebody in the present, which we won't say. He's also working out if he's obsolete. You know, somebody tells him that, you know, nobody needs you anymore. And that's as a man, as a partner, as a teacher, as a flyer, you know, all of these things. And I do think this is, you know, Tom Cruise absolutely at his best. And frankly, they don't give Oscars to these kind of films. But I think he should be in the running when it comes around. I think this is just excellent, excellent acting.
He does it all in a very sort of minimalist style as well. But yeah. It's very sort of controlled. But you watch young Tom Cruise, like I watched, like I said earlier, I watched Cocktail this week. And he's really turning on the megastar sort of charm, that it's a big performance and loud and a lot of shouting and grinning. And even though Maverick has that side to him, that he does have that big grin beneath his shades. Like you said, in this film, there's a bit of grief and there's a bit of melancholy. And he just does it all quietly, you know, with hardly a facial twitch. It's quite an interior performance and yet still has all that star quality. So, yeah, it's a fantastic performance. Like you said, the kind that never gets awarded. So I don't for a second expect to see him up at the Oscars. But it is, I agree, I think it's one of his best performances.
Cruise has held on to this film and not released it on any streaming. He didn't want that for this. This is to be seen on the big screen. I think we're saying you need to get out and see this on a big screen. Don't wait for a home ents release. Get out and see this on an IMAX, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. 100%. The sound design also was just so epic. And for many of us who watched the first film on telly, you know, I never had a chance to see this film because by the time I was, you know, I was born, it was already out. And I was just in awe of everything about it, you know, not just the cinematography, not just the lack of CGI, just making these stunts real, but just the sound design and the immersive experience it gives you. You feel like you're there with them, flying with them. And that is, as Jamie said, what a blockbuster is all about.
Just to say, I've seen it twice already.
Me too.
And I will be going to see it this weekend at my local cinema.
This is a film to watch with a huge crowd where you're all like, yes, go on. You're going to walk out on a cloud, aren't you, after it?
100%. In fact, my other half actually ran down the steps at the IMAX, you know, singing the theme tune. And his arms were out like he was flying. And that's how we all felt when we came out.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's hope you're all flying when you go and see it, because that is Top Gun Maverick and it is out now.
Hey, Maverick.
Yeah.
You hear about ice?
What's that?
You want another one?
Really?
Yeah.
I feel the need
for speed.
Ow! So next, what's Alex Garland up to these days? It's this. But
could it just be you staying? Or...
Excuse me?
Mrs. Modena?
No.
Until you give your love, there's nothing more that we can do.
Apple from the garden?
Yeah, it was delicious.
No. Mustn't do that. Forbidden fruit.
Oh, God, sorry, I
I'm joking. You're tormented.
It feels more like...
haunted.
So this is Men, and the only person that's seen this is Ashanti, because apparently the distributors don't want anyone else to see it. Jamie and I couldn't get a screening for Love Nor Money. So Ashanti, tell us, what is Men about?
Wow. So this film, I knew it was going to be a horror film. It's from A24 after all. They come out with weird and wonderful films. And it's been billed as a folk horror film, which was an interesting thing for me because I know Jane and Jamie know I'm not a big watcher of horror films. I kind of saw the cast. I thought, wow, Jessie Buckley, amazing actress. It's got Papa Essidieu, who I absolutely love. And it's also got Rory Kinnear, who acts as all the men in this film. It's actually... you know, a very interesting storyline by Alex Garland. I saw the film and I thought this film, in my head, I just thought a woman could have made this film and hit all the right notes just like Alex has done. So he has taken layers of the patriarchy and shown it in a very weird and wonderful way in that sense. And it follows a widowed, a young woman. She's lived in London. She's been married to Papa Essidieu's character. And he has taken his own life. you kind of get flashbacks of why and how that's happened. And she has decided she just needs to go to the English countryside all by herself. She's got her one friend who was in touch with her over video calls. And she goes to this little, what looks like a very beautiful town, and starts to see weird things happening around her. And this is where Rory Kinnear comes in. What a fantastic actor he is, for a start. I have to admit, I've not really seen many of his films. So him as, you know, he first presents himself as Jeffrey. He owns this kind of almost an Airbnb type holiday home that Harper has rented. And then he comes in as all the other men in that village. So she goes to the pub, she'll see them. She meets the police, she'll see them. And it's all played by Rory, who I think he's just, what a mind-blowing actor he is. It was hugely kind of triggering to me also. While I was watching this film, I felt quite triggered because I had escaped such a relationship like she had with her husband, the character called James Marlowe. And for me, watching it, I had to keep saying to myself, brace yourself, keep calm, because I didn't quite expect those layers to come into this film. I just thought it's going to be a lot of horror, lots of gory bits. But actually, there is a deep storyline, which is why I'm so gutted that Jamie and Jane didn't get to see this, because we could have had such a big discussion around this. Because Alex Garland, I'm putting my hat out to him, because it's awards worthy, the way he has thought about layers of the patriarchy from ancient times to modern times and brought that all into this film. And, you know, here's a man who's, you know, made films like 28 Days Later. And, you know, I loved his miniseries Devs, which also brought back similar themes, actually. That was on the BBC. You could probably still watch it. And this man is a genius. And this film is genius, because at the end of that film, though I was struggling watching it just because I had been in a similar situation to Jesse Buckley's character, was that I came out with a sense of resolution. I felt a sense of closure in the way this film ended. And that for me was absolute genius. I mean, it screened at Cannes, it did it very well. And I feel like I want to go to Coxon in Reddish, which is where it was shot. It's just so stunningly beautiful in bluebell season. You'll know why once you see this film. But at the same time, I wouldn't stay overnight there. it's a place I will go past and go through.
It sounds so intriguing. You know, Alex Garland has shown his sort of his ear for sort of the female experience with Annihilation. And that was also sort of put sort of that female experience via the lens of sort of sci-fi and horror. And so this sounds like he's done that again, but on a sort of more successful way, because Annihilation didn't quite work. So I'm really intrigued to see this. And of course, you know, Jessie Buckley's just an amazing actress. And Rory Kinnear, again, I've not really seen him really stretch his wings. He's that guy off the Bond movies to me, Tanner. I'm not really aware of him being able to do something else much more than that. My only sort of reservation, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that it might feel a bit League of Gentlemen with him playing all the different characters, or is it something that you just accept once it starts happening that he is all the different characters?
Well, for me, honestly speaking, I was kind of doing a double take each time, because I couldn't accept that it was the same guy, because his face seems to just bend and change in that way. I came out and I said to my other half of when I was talking about the film, saying I just didn't feel like it was the same man. He gave us such a different flavor every single time. And when you see the film, you'll know why I say that, because it's in his acting. I think that he's just played the role of a lifetime in that sense, and it's a masterclass in acting for sure. And it was completely a surprise to me.
Sounds cool. Jamie, are you going to be queuing up to see this when it comes out?
I will be queuing up to see this. I'm going to see Top Gun Maverick and Men this weekend.
No, you're not, because it's not out till Wednesday.
Oh, okay. I'm going to see it on Wednesday then. I like Alex Garland a lot. I thought Ex Machina was great. Annihilation, I agree. I think it didn't quite work, but it was really interesting and parts of it worked brilliantly. I think he's a really clever, you know, intelligent voice. He really has something to say. Devs, like Ashanti said, is wonderful. So I'm really intrigued to see it. I'm desperate to see it. And I asked to see it again and again for the last 6 weeks. And yeah, for some reason, they didn't show it to me. So that was nice.
All part of the intrigue, perhaps. So if you fancy seeing Men, it is out in cinemas next Wednesday. Okay, it is now time to curtsy. It's this.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to tell you all,
throughout the ages, it will not be easy.
We grew up loving the Queen. To us teenagers, she was a babe.
So this is Elizabeth, a portrait in parts, obviously timed to Mrs. Queen's Jubilee. Is it just a regular documentary of the Queen or what, Jamie?
Okay, well, this is a documentary of Queen Elizabeth II. It goes through her whole life from child up to present day. And it's the last film by Roger Mitchell, who, you know, great career, one of the kind of British stalwarts in a way. And a lot of people thought The Duke was his last film that came out earlier this year, which would have been a great signing off project because, you know, it's pretty wonderful. But he actually managed to fit in this documentary before he passed. And it was a perfect pandemic film in a way, because it's just all made from archive material. So there's nothing new in it. He's just kind of stitched together all this archive material, put it all together. There's no voiceover. There's no comment on anything that's happening. It's kind of, he said he wanted to make a celebration without judgment and just kind of, you know, look at this woman's life in a role of public duty throughout her life. I thought it was interesting in the way he stitched it all together, and it concentrates on certain key things like the Commonwealth, which was obviously very important to the Queen. And I liked it to a degree, but I kind of felt, part of me felt, what's the point? Because without the comment and without anything revelatory and without really digging into anything, and like I said, it's a celebration, so it does kind of skim along the surface. It's not going to sort of really ask difficult questions. I kind of came out the other end of it thinking, well, I didn't really get a lot from that, apart from seeing the archive footage, which is always interesting, and seeing how the country changed over the years, because obviously you go through things in the 70s, you get glimpses of National Front marches and stuff like that. So it's interesting, but I did come out kind of thinking, I don't really see the point. And I know it's for the Queen's Platinum Jubilee. And if you're a big royalist, I think you'll sit down and enjoy this and kind of just go with it. I'm kind of a bit on the fence. I'm not a royalist. I'm not anti-royal family by any means. I'm kind of on the fence of it. But I did come out of it just feeling it was all a bit tepid.
Mm. Tepid for you, Ashanti?
I was blown away, actually. I was absolutely blown away by this. Just the amount of archival footage and pop culture that they managed to integrate into this film. And I mean, I have to give a shout out to Joanna Crickmay, who was the editor of this film, and what an epic editing task she had. You know, to see it all, one, a woman editor, two, taking bits of footage, like, you know, it just completely blew my mind, the fact that they wove it all into these different chapters. And that's why it's a portrait in parts, because you see what this incredible woman who's now 96, and I'm no royalist by any means, but this film just completely swept me in. I mean, I'm thinking Roger Mitchell, you know, Notting Hill, born in South Africa to a British diplomat, Cambridge educated. He also directed something that I love, which was Hanif Qureshi's The Buddha of Suburbia. And, you know, obviously The Duke with Jim Broadbent and Helen Mirren. That was an absolutely fantastic film. But this, you know, it's of the world's most famous woman. And coming out also very cleverly, it hits Prime Video with her Jubilee. And it's in cinemas at the moment. And, you know, the pop culture in this, you've got, you know, when they brought in Stormzy's Heavy is the Head That Wears the Crown, I just felt like, what a touch of genius to bring this in. And, you know, you've got video clips, you know, from Aardman Animations and Peter Pan, Cleopatra, Star Trek, Peppa Pig, There's even like Akshay Kumar, a Bollywood clip of Akshay Kumar, because this is a woman who is not just a huge public figure that everybody in the world, anywhere in the world, pretty much recognizes, but also somebody who has touched popular culture in such a great way. And that's what, you know, those 22 pieces of music they put into this just completely blew my mind, the way they thought about it, you know, Let Me Entertain You and Our House from Madness, all of that was brought in. And I felt like, what a documentation of her life. I thought this was a beautiful, beautiful swan song for Roger Mitchell, because he's leaving us with a film that, you know, I feel like it does stand the test of time, because putting together and editing through a film like this is, to me, I can't even imagine doing that. I don't think I have the chops to sit down and go through the footage and then cut it in the right places and bring in the right segues every single time. So for me, this is a complete, please watch it, either on the big screen or the small screen. You will be riveted, especially if you like pop culture. And, you know, you're suddenly taken back to that time and you're thinking, whoa, Star Trek and the Queen, I never thought those two will be seen in the same space. But here they are. And here's a woman who has gone through all of that. She's seen all of that, as well as doing all her public duties. And I mean, I'm in huge admiration of what she does, even if not what she sometimes stands for.
Quite. Well, very well said, Ashanti. I don't think I have much to add to that, because I felt very much the same as you. I enjoyed it I found it was more of a sort of portrait of us, Britain, and the things that we've been through. And she was the constant throughout all of those things. And she's just the thing around these things revolve around. So I enjoyed that aspect of it. You know, I don't really have an opinion on the Queen, but I just, you know, we often hear that she has this great sense of humor, but we never see it. But actually, this did show that she's a little bit cheeky, a little bit irreverent. You know, she does have a sense of humor. And so I felt I knew her a little bit more than perhaps I had. It's not a film I would ordinarily seek out, a portrait of the Queen. But actually, I thought, oh, do you know what? I think I have sort of learned something about her, and also recognized something about, you know, the country I live in by watching it. So yeah, I think as you say, I think it's a masterful piece of editing, and the choices made and the music choices made and everything else. It sort of reminded me of how I felt about what Danny Boyle did at the Olympic ceremony. That it took an event but made it about Britain and made everybody feel that it represented them. And I feel like this film does a quite similar thing, that if you watch it, you'll recognize yourself in it. So yeah, as you say, it's out in cinemas, but it's also coming to Amazon Prime on the 3rd of June. So you can watch it either way. It's a democratic film in that way. Okay, so that is Elizabeth, A Portrait in Parts. Shall we move on then? It's time for alternative line reading, which I'm going to do in the style of Her Majesty. But obviously, as you know, it's a quote from somebody else we've talked about on this podcast. A nutless monkey could do one's job. Now go get drunk and take credit at all the parties.
That's a quite good impression, Jane, actually. Number one.
Your rendition of that has just completely blown me away.
Do you know what it's from?
I think I know.
What do you think?
It's Tom Cruise, isn't it?
It is Tom Cruise.
Tropic Thunder.
It is. It's Les Grossman. Yeah. And it sounds like this.
No, dickhead, of course I couldn't. A nutless monkey could do your job.
Well, I don't.
Now go get drunk and take credit at all the parties.
I would never do that to you.
Joking.
Yeah?
Yeah.
There he is.
Go have fun.
All right. Oh, we're having a fuck. Okay. Thank you, Les. Thank you. We have a good night.
But seriously, a nutless monkey could do your job.
Good.
Okay, so moving on. Do you fancy taking a ferry? It's this.
M'expliquez ce que vous faites ici, Madame Vinclair, quand vous courez après les heures de ménage. Je l'ai lu, votre dernier livre. J'en ai marre d'entendre parler de la crise, du chômage, de la précarité, d'une façon abstraite. J'ai besoin de voir, de partager le quotidien, pour voir ce qui se passe vraiment.
C'est vous la remplaçante ?
Faudra vous fouler plus que l'autre, hein ?
So this is Between Two Worlds. Ashanti, who's Between Two Worlds?
Between Two Worlds is the one and only and one of the most talented women in the world, Juliette Binoche, who brings the A game every single time, I feel, into her movies. Emmanuel Carrère has made this film, and it's about a character called Marianne Winkler. She's a well-known author, but she goes undercover to live in the north of France. She's there to research for a new book, and it's about the subject of job insecurity. And she doesn't kind of reveal her true identity, but she gets hired as a cleaner and starts to work with other women and starts to see a lot of, you know, how people are exploited in this kind of world. Now, for me, this film could have been so much more, but I felt that this is no Ken Loach movie. When you watch a Ken Loach movie, I, Danny Blake, Sorry We Missed You, you will feel in your gut what these people are going through. Whereas with this film, you kind of see, you see these things happening to them. You see a woman who's saying, gosh, I've had to make 1,000 of these beds in 1 hour and 4 minutes or whatever. They're given very stringent time limits to do these things in their job as cleaners. But you see this woman who is so privileged, and she goes into that world. And, you know, while she's in that world, and most of the film is them showing how this undercover kind of journalist is there working with them, seeing what they do. But I just felt that the film didn't give us the ultimate payoff. It didn't give us the call to action of what she could have done to help these practices. So it kind of went there, and it had this very, very good idea, but it didn't quite delve into that issue and say, okay, what can we do to make it better? I felt like what it did was just expose and show us what was happening in those worlds. And that for me, on one side, was very interesting. And I hope that maybe there's a follow-up to this, that, hey, this is what this character has done to help these people who are being exploited in their jobs, and how kind of these zero-hour contracts are affecting people and how difficult their lives are and how this can be made better. And that, for me, is what didn't click. But otherwise, very solid filmmaking, you know, beautiful acting by Binoche and her fellow cast. The ensemble was really on point. But yes, I just feel like the screenplay and the storyline could have worked a little bit better to actually make a difference in these people's lives, as opposed to, hey, here's a woman of extreme privilege coming in there, experiencing this and taking not much from it. You know, I wanted to see that little extra bit at the end of the film.
Did it work for you, Jamie?
I think it worked for me a little bit more than Ashanti, but for me, the ending of the film, the fact that it doesn't sort of wrap anything up or sort of give answers, felt kind of genuine to me, because it's kind of asking questions like, when she's doing this, is it proper investigative journalism? Is it a good thing, or is it exploitation?
Yeah.
And can she affect change, or can she not? You know, when her book comes out, will that change anything, or will privileged people just read that book and then move on with their lives, and nothing's going to change for these people who have to live this life day in, day out, who can't just do it for a couple of months to experience it and then go back to their nice little bubble? You know, these are people working jobs with no sick pay, you know, you can't take a day off, no holiday, just like no rights at all, really, yeah. On minimum wage. So I think it kind of asks those questions. For me, maybe the force of the film is the fact that this author, played by Juliette Binoche, the fact that she's very much at the centre of the film, it's kind of her story. And you see her kind of worries as well, you know, like she experiences a bit of guilt, or she's kind of worried about, is she doing the right thing or is she not doing the right thing? And maybe putting the emphasis on her rather than the women around her, who, you know, it is their life and it's their everyday thing. Maybe that feels a bit sort of skewered and a bit kind of, she shouldn't really be the centre of this story. It should be about the women around her, the cleaners. But having said that, I think, you know, it's really well made. It's really well acted. Juliette Binoche is absolutely great. And all of the women around her who are non-professionals,
yeah,
they were great. A woman basically called Christelle becomes her best friend in the film, played by Helene Lambert, who is a non-professional, and she's absolutely fantastic. You just can't take your eyes off her. And it asks that question as well, can you ever have a true friendship if you're hiding stuff, if you're telling lies, if you're deceitful? You know, that these women really click, but the truth will come out, and how will that affect them? You know, you're going to turn around and say, well, everything I thought I knew about you is fake. It's a lie. You know, I don't know you. So they ask these questions as well. And one of the things I liked about it is normally when you get these films, which are kind of social realism, they're all very gritty and they're handheld and all of this. And this film isn't like that, but it is made with a lot of urgency, but it's not a handheld camera. You know, it feels a little bit more sort of not as gritty in a way, which I think is good, because why does that have to be the language of social realism?
It's quite an elegant film, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. You know, why does a camera being slightly shaky, why does that mean that this is real, you know, that this is authentic? So I like that. I agree with Ashanti that I don't think it's as good as Ken. Like, Ken Loach has done a couple of recent films on similar subject matter. He's done I, Daniel Blake and Sorry We Missed You.
Yeah.
Which are both sort of about the gig economy and living on the poverty line. And I agree that they maybe make you feel more, that they sort of gut punch you and you really feel the lives of the characters and care for them more. But I did like this film. I liked it. I admired it. I would recommend it. You know, I think it's a good film.
Yeah. And, you know, it does make you feel angry and guilty and, you know, wanting to do something about it, which is, you know, a great mark of a film that's, you know, affected you, isn't it? So that is Between Two Worlds, which is out in cinemas on Friday. Right. Hold the gherkin on this. I don't know about you, but I don't love a gherkin in a burger. It's this.
I'm the marketing department. I took Gene's burger suit, let out the crotch a little bit, and bam.
A burger with a bikini on it?
Yeah. I get it. No questions from this guy.
So this is Bob's Burgers, the movie, obviously based on the popular animated show, which I have enjoyed. What's the difference with the movie, Ashanti?
Well, so let's just say that I went in totally cold. I've never seen Bob's Burgers as a teen.
Oh, wow. What a trip for you then.
It really was a trip for me. You know, especially when they kept jumping into song, for example, to tell their narrative. It's like a musical comedy film. But also, I had always thought of Bob's Burgers as being something that would appeal to children. And of course, this is a very kind of dark, it was a dark comedy in many ways. The basic storyline is that there's a ruptured kind of water main. It's a huge kind of sinkhole in front of Bob's Burgers. And people can't quite get in and buy their burgers. And they're trying to say, come in through the side entrance. They're having money problems, this family, the Belchers. And they want to have like a successful summer. But unfortunately, everything's gone awry for them. And they're trying to keep the business afloat. They've got these three very kind of quirky kids. And it, you know, interesting to see the kind of talent on display also. You've got H. John Benjamin there as Bob Belcher, Dan Mintz as Tina Belcher, Eugene Miram as Jean Belcher. And then you have all the people around them. And of course, Jocelyn Kristen Sachal as Louise Belcher. And they make a really cool kind of motley crew set around a theme park, lots of really funny bits, lots of really dark bits that, as I mentioned, I didn't quite expect. Aziz Ansari there as Dari in this, and Jenny Slate as Tammy. So it was quite nice to see that kind of voice cast coming together in this film and seeing them all kind of break out into song that literally fits in with the narrative. I thought was very clever storytelling. And as Jane said, what a trip. Because I went and saw it in a themed screening, which had, you know, burgers. At the start, we had burgers. They fed us burgers. You could have vegan, you could have vegetarian, and you could have the real deal. And, you know, it all felt kind of very, very American. It's kind of a very all-American movie in that sense. But also there were some very beautiful storylines in this about, especially one of the children who had, you know, she has this kind of the bunny ears, and you know, you kind of discover a lot about her, because I guess for maybe if you watch the series, you probably know a lot about her character, but you kind of then discover that she is on a journey of self-discovery in this film. And I really like the way that was all set up and brought to us. And yes, you know, what can I say? It's how this family kind of sticks together. to conquer a challenge. Can't go wrong with a storyline like that. And, you know, it was a nice kind of runtime also, so I didn't feel bored at any point. I felt connected to, you know, all the characters, which, again, for somebody who'd never seen it, yeah, it felt quite good. And I would say that you kind of come out of this film with a smile on your face, you know?
Yeah, which, I mean, the show is very much like that as well, isn't it? It's like, there's a real warmth to this. It's not full on snark. There's real heart in this show, and it's funny, but not funny for the sake of it. It's sort of like watching a, you know, classic sitcom, like Family Ties, which is taking me back now, but there's that warmth in that family. So it's lovely to see that. And you know, coming out for half term might be kids that enjoy that as well, especially, you know, the mum wearing a full burger suit that she's let the crotch out and added a bikini. Great look.
I have to admit that if you go onto my socials, you'll see me wearing that same suit.
I'm going there now. Scrolling. Okay, so this is Bob's Burgers, and it is out on the big screen, not the small screen, this Friday. Okay, that's it. That's all we've got time for this week's episode. But before we go, there's obviously time for a reader's question. And this one is, what movie candy would you like to eat? Ashanti.
Oh, so I read it in two ways. Obviously, if I went to a British movie theatre, the candy I would eat would be Haribo. I think anybody who kind of grew up in the UK will go for that. But if it were, you know, from a movie, and I know it was disgusting in the film, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, because he had gummy bears.
Oh, the warm gummy bears.
Warm and soft, yes.
It's been in my pocket.
I would just like a normal gummy bear, lots of them in different flavors, and that's what I'd like to eat, but not warm, not sitting in anyone's pocket.
Not furry.
It's nice and no. Nice and fresh and clean and all of that. That's what I would like.
Jamie?
As you know, Jane, as everyone knows, Stand By Me is my favorite film of all time. So I would just quote Vern on this and say, if I could only eat one food for the rest of my life, that's easy. Pears, cherry flavored pears. So there okay. you go. I don't even know what pears is.
It's those little sweeties that you have a little dispenser and you flip the lid and a little like, and it comes out like a lozenge.
I've eaten those. They're nice. Yeah.
Yeah. So, the cherry ones are very good.
Cherry flavored pears.
Okay. I think I would have to go for Willy Wonka's magic chewing gum that was a 3-course meal. I think that's like when I was a kid watching that, I was just like, imagine that. And now I'm like, I would love that as well. But I wouldn't want the tomato. I think it was tomato soup and a roast and then a blueberry pie. I'd want you to be able to like choose what that 3-course meal would be and then chew it. Yeah. And then I got into thinking like, would sushi flavored chewing gum be a nice thing? Possibly not. So then you might have to, you know, exercise some caution on what you actually chose in that 3-course meal. But that would be a great sweet. I'd love that. Okay, so next week we're on a hiatus for the Queen's Jubilee Bank Holiday, but we will have a Total Films Last Picture Show coming out. And then we'll be back week after when we'll be reviewing a little tiny film called Jurassic World Dominion. So please join us. But for now, we'll say thank you to our Top Gun recruits. Say goodbye, all.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.